Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was young, was
hello and welcome to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold on the side of the studio, and just across the way, George P. Fraser, a very multi-talented person who once made an omelet. George, how are you?
No, I never have.
I thought you did.
Scrambled egg thing, though.
I thought you actually made an omelet once. I didn't know. So I
now,
I feel like I need to take that back. You're not
that
talented.
Yeah, that wasn't true. It should be. You would think a person could do that, but I'm incapable. How are you tonight?
I'm good. Billy? I'm good. I'm hopeful because spring is ahead. And for guys like us who live in Minnesota, we're always looking forward to spring.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally.
So
got a great show tonight, too.
Yes. And make sure, well, it's obviously a little bit lighter. It's going to stay lighter longer starting, obviously, today. So, you know, as we pushed our clocks ahead, now it's going to be lighter a little longer, and I'm okay with that, too.
I always feel sleep-deprived till the fall. How about you, Bill?
Yeah, I understand how you feel, George. So we have a great show. Sinai's coming on. It's a name I've not heard before, except in the Bible, but he's our guest tonight, and we're going to hear his story. But before that, George, you know, we always like to take a step out of the 12 steps and talk about it. I think tonight we're going to focus on step 10.
I like step 10, and it's continue to take our personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. And the reason, Bill, I wanted to talk about this tonight, I lost one of my mentors a couple weeks ago, or my last corporate president, back when I had a real job long time ago.
Yeah.
And his name was Ed Lindbergh. And Ed mentored me. He, strong Christian guy, really a servant leader. Everybody loved him. And I was thinking about my relationship with him. Funny how God brings people into your life. And I wasn't sober when I started working for him. And I got sober that year. And he had a gentle hand that was very firm, but I wanted to be like it. I never was. And I used to go in his office and say, you wouldn't have done this the way I did it. And his head would hit the back of his chair because he knew what was coming. And then when he got the bifocals, I used to stand like 10 feet away and then 15 feet away. But he thought I was funny. But I remember one time I went in, I had gotten a big sale, and I said, Ed, how am I doing? And he looked at me and said, how do you think you're doing? And it was like, I don't know. I never really thought about that. That's what step 10 is. How do you think you're doing?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you think you're doing with God's will in your life? We get to that in the next step, but we also got to that in three when we turned our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand him. We understand him to be Jesus Christ because that's who he is. There used to be those bracelets, what would Jesus do? Well, that's a good reminder of step 10 for me. And it's not just things I'm doing wrong. We have progressed now. We're growing along spiritual lines on the sanctification process to be more holy, Bill. I want to look at, am I saved? Yes. Am I sober today? I got those two things going for me. Have I committed some awful sins? We have to confess our sins daily. And if we confess, he's faithful to forgive us. What's that, 1 9.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to look at, are there things instead of committing sins, am I omitting things I could do?
Mm-hmm.
And where this always goes, we're going from step 1 to step 12. And as Steve Covey used to say, one of the 7 habits is you begin with the end in mind. We're going to step 12 where we carry this message to other people. If you get saved and sober, God has a job for you to do. And you are uniquely qualified to walk with people that have struggled with what God has allowed you to overcome. You speak their language. You know the territory where they're walking. You know the shame, the disappointment in your life, the loss. There's a lot of loss to addiction, loss of self-esteem, loss of connection with God, loss of health. And you can join these people where other people can't because you have a purpose. How many people are you working with? When somebody asks you to go speak at an event, we don't say no to anything that we can do, Bill. And how are we looking at that? So I thought about that when Ed said that to me. George, how do you think you're doing? Well, if I was using, I would have told him I'm doing great, you know. But now that I was trying to be a mature adult, which I thought, you know, I was 27, 28 years old. It was time, Bill. And what are you doing is a better question than how are you doing? Because when I look at how I think I'm doing, I need to back that up. We go to the book of James. It says faith without works is dead. And faith to me, oh, sure, I believe in Jesus. I know those stories in the Bible are true. Do I believe it enough to do it? Do I believe it enough to trust it? That's where the iron really sharpens iron, is getting other people. What do you see in me? Bill, you're a very close friend. We have, you know, the understanding that we can mutually question each other on what we're doing and go to each other and have it stay there, asking questions. But I think we need to look at these occasionally and then ask other people, really, how do you think I'm doing? Here's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to be a sober Christian guy, carry the message, practice his principles in all my affairs. But how are you doing? And every day, Bill, at night before I go to bed and I say my prayers, and I still say the "Now I lay me down to sleep" prayer. I've been saying that since I was a little kid. In case I die overnight, you know, you want to cover yourself. How could I have done better today? Were there some things I said I didn't need to? Every day there's one or two, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, well, because it's funny, that gives me license to do it. But what could I have done differently today and then try to do that tomorrow? Mm. How about you? How do you work this one?
Well, you know, the question I ask myself is, do I confuse the difference between my feelings and my actions? And then how am I doing when it comes to just promptly admitting when I'm wrong? And I think I get fairly good at that, the admitting when I'm wrong. That seems to be pretty clear to me pretty fast. And
do you accept it, though? I mean, do you fight it like I do? I try to rationalize it sometimes.
Well, I'm sure I do a little bit. Yeah. But when you have a, you know, a public platform like we do and you're on the radio and you make a mistake, you can't wait to correct it.
Does it help when I'm listening to your show and I text you?
No, that actually just bothers me. That annoys me. Yeah.
But it's and I know you always talk about the non-negotiables. Before you go to bed at night, do you look back on your day and see if you check those off?
I do, but probably by the time I get to that stage of the day, I have already been confronted with them and have dealt with them. Because honestly, there are times when I will be a not-so-pleasant driver, and it'll hit me instantly, and I will ask for forgiveness, and I will confess saying, you know, "Lord, help me." And then there'll be times when I will be annoyed with someone, and I'll stop in my tracks, and I'll think, this person is created in the image of God. So I feel like my response time is getting faster. But I do look back when I get in bed at night and lay down and I think, "Lord, thank you for hearing my prayers, forgiving my sins, and your mercies that are new every day."
You know, you hit on a real good point there, Bill. I can work step 10 during the day by thinking, this isn't what I want to do, and I'm going to really feel bad about this one afterwards.
Yeah.
And that keeps me out of making amends to people.
All right.
So that's a real good point, yes.
Let's take a little break, bring on our guest, Sinai. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We'll be right back.
Can get it wrong and still think that it's all right.
Welcome back to Real Recovery. Glad you joined us tonight. We're awfully glad to be welcoming Sinai to the show tonight to hear his story of hope and redemption and what God has been doing in his life. It's always exciting to hear those stories, George. I never, ever, ever tired of hearing them.
No, and it's God's story in our lives, and we get to see somebody that was down out, and God lifts them up, gives them a new purpose, forgives them, and helps them get sober. I never get tired of them either.
Yeah. And George, might you say our guest tonight has one of the more unusual names that we've had in the 10 years we've been doing the show?
It's a first.
Mm-hmm. And so we're going to learn all about him and his name. His name is Sinai. Sinai, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'd love to hear a little bit about the origin of your name.
Okay, so my father was, he's no longer with us, but he was a pastor. So I grew up a pastor's kid. And the story that I've been told was I was born in Indianapolis, and my father was in the Twin Cities actually preaching about the Ten Commandments and Moses and the Israelites. So that's how I got my name, because he was actually was not there at my birth, because he was doing ministry work here in the Twin Cities. And, you know, I mean, I kind of look back at it and I said, I could have been named the Ten Commandments, but he gave me Sinai. And it's actually, you know, and it's a name that I've just grown accustomed to.
I love it. So tell us, okay, you're a pastor's kid. So give us a little idea of what it was like growing up for you.
Okay. So life for me was, you know, very different than a lot of the stories that I've heard, you know, being in treatment. I come from a pretty big Hmong family. There are 11 of us, and there are seven boys, six brothers I have, and four sisters. Being a pastor's kid, I did grow up in the church. It was, you know, multiple times a week. My dad actually was a pastor of a church on Grand Avenue and 31st. At that time, he was a Christian Missionary Alliance pastor. He then moved over to 13th and Lake Street, which is now Christ International, where he had a Assembly of God Hmong church. He also had a radio show on an older radio station that no longer is around, but KNOF. So growing up with a father who was a pastor, I mean, it was difficult, you know, always trying to meet his standards and always trying to, you know, play the part of having friends and being in the church and growing up in the church. We did a lot, my siblings and I, you know, part of, I'm just recalling, like, I was an usher, I was a cameraman, I played on the band, I was a drummer. I was also in the youth choir, you know, so there was a lot of that involved in our lives, that my dad would use my brothers and sisters and I to help with the ministry.
Mm-hmm. George, are you getting resentful at all, considering how much talent he has?
You know, it's interesting, all the stuff he's doing. Did you like doing that?
You know, I think at a younger age, I did. But as I grew, you know, into the teenage years, it was my friends are doing this, people are doing that. And here I am on, there was a period of time where my dad had a church in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So we would go to, on a Sunday, we would go to church in Minneapolis at 12, and at 3 o'clock, we'll go to his, to the church in St. Paul. So our Sundays were always taken up, and, you know, sometimes it became a burden, and I think looking back, it kind of pushed me away from God a little bit, just because I was so involved.
Hmm. So busy going to church, doing things related to church, but maybe not connecting the way you would be liking to connect with God.
Yes, correct.
So that's a big family you had. So tell me what happened when you started to experiment with drugs or alcohol.
Okay. So, you know, my addiction really started when I was about 17 years old. I was in high school, and that's when I first started drinking. And then I went into college. I went to a school in St. Paul. And I started to drink on the weekends. And at the time, I didn't think it was a problem, because everybody was drinking on weekends. And I was able to maintain and manage work, school, and drinking on the weekends with my college friends. And then in 2001, that's when things kind of just started to spiral down, and that's when my father passed away. Today is actually 21 years of his passing.
So sorry.
Yeah, thank you. And the last conversation I had with my dad was us arguing. We were arguing over the woman that I was dating, and he didn't approve of her. And, you know, in that argument, I said some things that I wish I didn't. And, you know, I cursed him and all that a teenager does to their parents because they think they're right. And then unfortunately, 2 days after that, he passed, he had a heart attack. And then 3 weeks after having a heart attack, he passed away. So I was never able to restore that relationship with my father, and it kind of carried me in my addiction for 20 years. And I started drinking a lot more. I started trying to mask and numb the pain. I mean, I was mad at myself. I was mad at my dad. I was mad at God for taking him so early and not giving me the opportunity to restore that relationship. First, is a little bit of selfish thinking. You know, I started hanging out with the wrong people, going out to clubs, you know, just doing things of this world that I'm no longer proud of. And the drinking just continued to get worse. And in 2006, I married the woman I love, who actually is the woman that my dad didn't want me to be with. And I honestly thought at the time that I got married that getting married to someone could help me change my addiction or my drinking issues. And I really didn't think it was an addiction at that time, but, you know, today I do realize that it was an addiction. The continued drinking just caused stress on our marriage, and in the way I was living and behaving just pushed her away more and more. And then in 2008, we had our only child, our daughter, Madeline. And again, I thought, okay, having a daughter might fix me. It might fix my marriage. It might fix my addiction to alcohol. And it didn't. And things got worse from there. And after my daughter was born, you know, I remember that fall. It was the fall of 2008 is when the first time I started using cocaine. And cocaine started as just a weekend drug with friends. And I was able to maintain, go to work, and so on and so forth. And then that continued for a couple years. And then in 2013, it was just too much for my wife, and she filed for divorce. And that's when the cocaine use started to increase. That's when cocaine and alcohol became one drug. If I had cocaine, I needed alcohol. If I had alcohol, I needed cocaine. And it was just adding on to the way of numbing, you know, the anger I had from my dad's passing, and now trying to numb myself from having to deal with the shame and the regret of a divorce. You know, so over the next 6 years, from 2013 until I entered treatment at Teen Challenge, I mean, I couldn't maintain a job. You know, I lost a car. I lost my apartment. I was stealing and lying from family. I was using multiple times a week. And, you know, I would go to work high. And that's when my family stepped in. And actually, let me back up a little bit. And then this is where medically my life just changed. And I recall in September 2017, it was the start of my medical issues. And I was at home, and the TV was literally spinning in the room. And I went to the hospital in St. Paul Health East, but they ambulanced me over to the cardiology department in St. Joe's, which is now, I believe, Fairview. I was diagnosed with congested heart failure, stage 2 liver and kidney failure. And today I'm 42 years old. So this was 5 years ago. So I was, you know, 37. And in those 8 to 10 days that I was in the hospital, I coded. And all I remember, and I remember having to be resuscitated And when I came to, I just remember the medical team all around me. And they obviously recommended that I stopped using drugs and stop smoking and stop drinking. But I was able to stop smoking, but I continued to drink and I continued to use cocaine secretly. And then unfortunately, again, in 2019, January, I had a heart attack. And I was 39 years old, and part of it is hereditary, right? Like I told you, my dad had a heart attack, so high blood pressure, heart issues were in my family line, but the smoking, the drinking, and the cocaine definitely didn't help. So I had a heart attack, and I was taken to North Memorial. That's when one of the doctors told me that my troponin levels were so high that he said I had a heart attack. And again, you know, when I had the heart attack, I was on day four of a 3-day binger of using alcohol and cocaine. And it happened on the fourth day. And, you know, I recall being in the hospital and the girl I was dating at that time, she goes, I have to call your brother. And I was so mad at her wanting to tell my family because I was in shame. Of my medical issues and my relapse that I didn't want her to tell anybody. And I recall telling her that if she called my brother, I would break up with her. You know, I came to my senses and I called my family and they were supportive. And so after that heart attack, you know, now I stopped drinking, but then I started to pick up using cocaine again, just within weeks of having that heart attack. And in the spring, March of 2019, I actually had a defibrillator placed in my chest, which also works as a pacemaker. And I continued to use even after that. It wasn't until the end of May, beginning of June, that my family had an intervention with me. And that's when I came clean about, you know, the constant lying and stealing and the alcohol use and the cocaine use. And that's when, you know, they loved me pretty much right into Teen Challenge.
Hmm. All right. That is a story. Unbelievable, Sinai, that God has saved you and more than once because he has a purpose for you and your life. And I know we're going to get to that later in the show, but that's a powerful start. George, any thoughts before break?
We got a lot of questions when we come back.
Yeah, I know you do. That's just like George Fraser, always with the questions. What am I supposed to do with you?
Never have any answers, though, do I?
We'll take questions from George when we get back. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We got Ryan on the board, who never makes a mistake. That's what I love about Ryan. We'll be right back.
Never met a man stranger. Lives his life for a dollar sign. And the deal with him is dangerous. Well, he knocked me down, but I'm on my feet. Now I'm a soul.
I remember when I lost my.
Welcome back to Real Recovery. Thank you for joining us tonight. If you just started listening to Real Recovery, we're awfully glad that you are doing that. And you can always go to myfaithradio.com. We have a lot of episodes on the website. You can just check out the podcast. We'd love for you to, if you hear one that really resonates with you or someone else that you would like to send this to, just head over to myfaithradio.com. You can take it from there. Sinai is our guest tonight. And George, you can start asking questions district attorney style.
No, that brings back bad memories for me, too. So,
all right.
How were you paying for the coke?
Well, you know, I was pretty fortunate. I had jobs that, you know, I would consider them career. They're, you know, I made pretty good money. But even though I was making $50,000, $60,000 a year, I was living paycheck to paycheck because that's what I was doing, was spending all my money on cocaine. And you know, I got into some friendships where I knew people who I could drive around, for example, and my payment would, I would be paid in drugs. Because I had a legal driver's license and, you know, and I had a clean record, and that's how I got some drugs, but a lot of it was paying for it and living a life where I'm, you know, I'm paycheck to paycheck waiting for, to get paid to get high.
Mm. If I can ask the next question, George, relative to what you just asked, when you say you drive around, were you helping people without valid licenses get to places, or were you part of a drug delivery system?
No, just helping people get around.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, George, what else you got?
Well, I was going to advise him he did need to answer that question. He could take the fifth on that.
Yeah.
But were you still going to church? And if you were, did you have the double-minded, unstable and all that he does thing going? Did you have a, you know, a different life with your church people and then with your using people?
Yeah. So, you know, and my church people were family. You know, I recall my sister-in-law who came alongside me in those last couple of months, and she would take me to Crossroads in Woodbury. And the way I behaved around her and my brother and their family, and while I was in church, then, you know, church is over, and here I am hanging out with my friends, watching football and using and getting high. And I lived a double life for many years, you know, to put on the picture of being someone who had it all together and also someone who was getting high, you know, every other day.
Did that wear on you a little bit?
I think so. I think it emotionally took a part of me. You know, I got to the point where I was lying and I was believing the lies that I was telling. And it became part of my story, part of my life, that, you know, that lie, I had a lie to cover up a lie so that my stories would stay straight.
I totally get that. Did you get to the point, though, where you couldn't discern between reality and fantasy?
Yes, definitely. You know, I always thought, just thinking back, like, I just thought that no matter what I did, I would, you know, never get in trouble, right? And obviously that is not reality. And I continued to just push the line on what I thought I could do and what reality really was.
Were you worried about your sanity?
Yes, I was. I mean, you know, I thought there were points in my addiction where I thought everybody hated me. I thought my family hated me. I thought my work was out after me. And after coming clean and you know, where I am today and look back and I have conversations with people, that was completely untrue. And it was people that were trying to, you know, come into my life to come alongside me and to love me and to help me get the care that I needed. And I was thinking that they were trying to, you know, destroy my high and stop me from getting high.
So as you get more and more lives going and you have a double life going and you got to keep the paycheck coming in, I would imagine the paranoia is increasing daily.
Yes. And you know, when I first started using drugs or cocaine, like, there wasn't much paranoia. It got to a point where, you know, I was high and you would constantly think that the police were coming or someone's knocking on the door. Why does it sound like something's in my wall? You know, all that paranoia of life and I guess fantasy of creatures just, you know, running across your vision. But then the real paranoia was always thinking, having to look over my shoulder and always being worried that I was going to get caught.
Yep. Did she try to quit at all? Did you ever go, hey, this isn't me, I need to cut this out?
Yes, after 2017, when I coded and flatlined, you know, I went, that's when I quit smoking, and I did go 6 months, 5-6 months ish of not using alcohol or cocaine. And then I relapsed, and that relapse was the one that, you know, kind of hit really hard, and I started to use probably twice as much as I was before.
Sonny, I have to ask, because you come from a big family, so you got six brothers and some sisters and parents, and so I'm just wondering, I know your dad's gone at this point, but do you have brothers and sisters that are saying to you, confronting you, saying, we know what's going on in your life, you have to change?
Yes, towards the end. But, you know, in a majority of my addiction, I isolated.
Okay.
You know, even when I was married, you know, my wife and I at the time, you know, we would do our own things. And then after my divorce, I isolated. I quit going to family events. I quit going to church with my family, because it was easier to just stay away than to try to live that double life that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm. What were your excuses for not showing up at stuff?
Work. You know, I had a job for a couple of years where, you know, I did travel.
Okay.
And you know, that's even, you know, that's another story in itself, where I would travel between here and Colorado for work. But then somehow I happened to be able to, you know, continue my addiction out there as well. And, you know, so I would use work as an excuse to stay away from family and to just say, hey, I'm busy. I got a busy week next week, so I'm not going to hang out.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to see your daughter at all?
So my daughter, she's 14 now, or she turns 14 in April. And, I haven't. So my mom passed away when I was in the program in 2021, and that's the last time I saw my daughter. And prior to that was before the divorce. You know, and that's a relationship that is still being worked on. It's still being restored by God, and I believe He will restore that one day. But right now, she's in a spot where I think she's blaming me for the divorce, and she knows about, you know, my journey now, and I think there's some resentment that she's working through. So she hasn't been okay with even texting me or talking to me or seeing me. And and I hope, you know, I know that God's going to restore that for me one day.
Mm-hmm. Sonny, I'd love for you to get to the part of the story now where if you didn't have Jesus showing up in your life and transforming your heart and mind, you'd still be where you were before.
Yeah. So I think to answer that, I mean, you know, I want to take a look at where I am today. You know, I came to, and I'm not sure if you guys are all familiar with Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. I'm sure you are.
We are very familiar with it.
But that's the program that my sister got me into, my sister-in-law got me into with the help of my family. And it was, I mean, I knew who Jesus was. I knew who God was before coming in. But then I never had that relationship with Jesus. It was just going through the routines and just doing what I had to do to get my parents off my back, so to speak. And my second or third day here at Teen Challenge, while I was in the short-term program, there was a chapel service in the morning, and I recall it, I vividly. And I thought to myself while we were worshiping that morning, and I thought to myself, here is a bunch of guys and gals, men and women, who come from different walks, who have different stories who are different in their ethnicity, in their color, their age, and all are, you know, worshiping Jesus. And that morning was, the speaker was Nick Hall from Pulse Movement, and I recall what he said, and it's stuck in my head. And what he said that morning was, there are so many people in the world who would give up a year of their life to be with where you are today. So take advantage of it. And then that morning I made a commitment to Jesus, to God, that I would complete the long-term program and that I would do whatever I could to not be high anymore and to live a different lifestyle and to change my behavior. And so, so that kind of set my whole treatment. And that's kind of when I would say I rededicated my life to Jesus. And then I completed the short-term program. Then I moved to the long-term program, which is an intense outpatient program with Teen Challenge. I started in July of 2019. And in the long-term program, I learned a lot. I mean, I learned how to be obedient, to be patient. And the most important thing was learning how to let God take control of my life and kind of just letting go of the control, the human aspect of always wanting to control my life. One thing I recall is like I was told, you know, about, you know, I started making good practices or godly practices. Like I started reading the Bible. I started praying daily. I would be in worship and over time, those practices became my principles. And that's kind of how I live today. But, you know, there were still things that I was holding on to from my past life. And, I was still struggling with my father passing, my divorce, and the shame of being in treatment. And one thing is there was a lot of shame for my family or in me for my family, because in our culture, it's just, it's really looked down upon when someone has to go through treatment or needs mental health. And, you know, for me to I felt that me being in that situation would cause my family to be looked down on. And so there was shame in that and all having to deal with that, having to deal with all that. And I also was in a relationship that was unhealthy. And, you know, one day in November, I just remember hearing a voice saying that if I didn't break up with her, that I wouldn't be able to go on this journey that he had planned for me, he being God. And I knew that that relationship was toxic for me because even though I wasn't following Jesus like I am today, I considered myself a Christian. And she was not a Christian. She was actually Muslim, and there was no way that was going to work. You know, I was not going to convert, and she was not going to convert. And I believe that it was probably one of the best decisions I made that helped me in my recovery and helped me in my spiritual walk was to break up with her, and to concentrate the rest of my program on building a relationship with Jesus. You know, and through that, like through the clinical help that I got at Teen Challenge and the spiritual help I got at Teen Challenge, the anger and the resentment of blaming myself for my father's death and the anger I had towards God and the shame of my divorce, I was able to work through all that, all that shame and all that regret. You know, so the Teen Challenge long-term program did a lot in my recovery.
Sinai, we're complicated creatures. There's no question.
We are.
We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll hear more of what God's doing in Sinai's life. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We'll be right back. We are back with our guest, Sinai. We're hearing his story tonight. George, quite a story.
You know, it's very powerful, and many parts of it. One thing that jumped out, Bill, is that I have a heart attack. I, you know, as he said, he coded. He's brought back, gets out, quit smoking, but we're still drinking and doing coke. Mm-hmm. And you might hear that and go, how could you do that? Well, you lose the power of choice when you're addicted.
So if you don't have a plan, an intervention, and the transforming power of Christ, your odds of making it are pretty slim.
I think your odds of making it are pretty slim with all that. And as we know, most people don't make it. It's a mystery to me. It's a miracle that anybody ever gets sober.
Mm-hmm. So Sinai, you have traveled quite a journey. God has really given you a new purpose in life. I'd love to hear about the work you're doing with others and helping others right now, and what God has for you in terms of vision for your life.
Yeah, love to share that part. So right now, so I completed the long-term program in July of 2020. And then I continued over to TCLI, which is the Leadership Institute for Teen Challenge. And, you know, it's like another year-long program where you're living in communal living and you're going to Bible classes. And they're taught, you know, half the classes are Mensam classes for Assembly of God credentials. So, I, you know, that's where I was able to solidify my relationship with Christ. I actually, for the first time, you know, was baptized in the Holy Spirit, and I was, you know, given the gift of tongues and being, you know, started to feel more comfortable in my praying for other people and praying corporately. And so I graduated while at TCLI. You know, I started school. I went back to Crown College, and I started to go to school full time, and I was in a leadership full time. I had an internship at TCLI, so I was doing all three of those things at the same time. And He's blessed me every step of the way. Somehow, a good chunk of my college courses from 1997 and 1998 were still eligible for transfer.
That's nice.
So I only had to do 2 years, and I'm in my last year at Crown to get a BA in Christian ministries and a minor in alcohol and drug counseling.
Yeah. So God's really taken you quite a distance, Sinai.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about your relationships with your family. Have those been largely, are they active and restored and all that?
Yeah, they are. Like my family was, even when I didn't think they were my biggest supporters, you know, they've all told me, hey, I was praying for you when you were in your darkest. And now, like, you know, my family, they trust me again. They're able to lend me their vehicle, you know, one of their pickups if I need it, you know.
Yeah.
I watched the house for one of my brothers. So I'm able to, I've restored all those relationships. And my siblings have been absolutely, you know, lifesavers. I mean, they came alongside me in my darkest times, and here they are, you know, congratulating me every step of the way, every achievement, every milestone I've hit. Yeah. They've been by my side.
So the trust has been rebuilt, because I would never lend my car to George.
I'd never drive that thing.
No.
I mean, come on, I got some standards.
But trust is a big issue, and boy, that's God as well, rebuilding the trust among family who you isolated from, and they probably grew to not trust you at all, and now it's coming back. That's an incredible blessing, Sinai.
Yeah,
hey, Billy. You know, along those lines, one of the real mirror back to us moments can be that if we're a new creation in Christ, we're going to see how other people see that in us. And by giving us responsibility, that's a real measure that God's done something in my life.
So true. So true. So the fruits of your life are now becoming more and more evident, and God is giving you all kinds of opportunity, which is always the case. Isn't that true, George? Whenever you ask God to give you opportunities to do ministry, especially with people in drug and alcohol addiction environments, you're going to get exactly what you asked for.
Yeah, I think what we have to look at is we have a purpose now, that we're part of God's army to help others. We're the skin and flesh that mm-hmm. they read about, and he's got a ministry, and mm-hmm. he's going to school for it. And what you find, if God is with you, nothing is impossible, but you enjoy this because this is what you were created to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it gets any better than that, Bill. The people that work with other people to help them get sober, when somebody relapses, our good friend Glenn always says, how many guys were you working with when you went back to using? And the answer, Bill, is usually zero.
Yeah. Sinai, would that be something you would agree with as well? When you had relapses, were you working with anybody? Were you coming alongside anybody, encouraging them?
No, I wasn't. When I relapsed, I was in dark isolation. The people I hung out with weren't in a position to help me, you know? I would agree with that.
I think part of that, Bill, is it's pretty hard to give something away that we don't have.
Mm-hmm. So true. Mm-hmm. So true. So I find your story, Sinai, to be amazing in as much as you relapsed several times after you had some warnings from health doctors, from medical people that said, boy, you could die. And for some reason, you had the addiction still active enough in you that you were able to go use.
Mm-hmm.
That's remarkable to me.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
That's God showing up in a significant way. That's what I love about your story.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And you know, and all the glory obviously goes to him. It's like you said, he's showing up in my life and, you know, doing things in my life and allowing me to just pretty much, you know, be on the ride.
Mm-hmm. We just have about a minute left. Do you have any encouragement you'd like to share with others?
Yeah, my encouragement, you know, would be, you know, if someone's lost hope, and the biggest thing that I had to overcome was self-hatred or having issues with myself because I felt less than because of the situation I put my family and my friends in. Know that, you know, if you are open and you go to the people that love you and you tell them you have a problem that you need help, your family and your friends are going to be willing to help you. And it's not that you're alone. And, you know, we think that we're alone when we're in addiction, but we have so many people that want to help us and we just don't know how to reach out.
Mm.
So I would say reach out.
Yeah. Amen. Always good advice to reach out if you are suffering. That is one takeaway for tonight for sure. That's all the time we have. Sinai, thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you.
George, as always, it's a pleasure. That wraps up another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Have a great week, everyone. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.